Mara, and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How are you? Hope you had a good weekend. I, Mark Riley, how are you?
I'm doing great, man. How are you doing? How was the weekend?
The weekend was pretty good. I did some good comedy, had a good time. I think I picked up one of these stupid summer air conditioning-based colds.
Oh, man.
That was brought into the office by Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, the conduit of virus that has given me and no, but you know what? Everyone has it.
The viral off-ramp.
Everyone has it, man. You know, when you live in a city that's this humid, this hot, and you're going in and out of air-conditioned spaces, and you're sleeping with the air conditioner on, one little bug gets out there in the world, and within days, the entire city is sick. I think you had it last week. You were hiding it, though. You're not a whiner like me.
Well, you know, my biggest problem is when I get out of my car when it's air-conditioned, and suddenly my glasses fog over, right? This is the first time I've ever...
Wow.
But you know what? I was up in Massachusetts over the weekend, and I had two very interesting experiences.
How was that drum corps?
It was wonderful. Uh-huh. It was a wonderful event. I went to semifinals on Friday and finals on Saturday. On Friday night, I run into an old friend of mine.
Yeah.
Guy I've known for like 20-odd years. And he says to me, "Hey, Mark, you still working for that communist radio station?"
Yeah, the communist radio station. He knew the original title,
I guess. Guy. Yeah. Yes, he knew about that. Yeah, W Commie.
Yeah,
he knew about that.
I'm glad we didn't pick that one.
Yeah,
that
really.
That would have alienated people.
But then Saturday night, I'm sitting up in the stands, up in the top part of the stands, with, you know, about 30,000 of my closest friends.
Yeah.
And I get up because they're emptying out the stadium because there's lightning coming, right?
Right.
And I turn around, and a guy says to me, "Are you Mark Riley?"
Yeah.
I said, "Wait a minute. Do I owe you money?"
Yeah.
No, I listen to you guys every morning.
Yes.
I love what you guys do. So.
Oh, that's nice. You're getting recognized from the radio in Foxborough Stadium, one of 30,000 people, and he says he's proud to sit next to Riley.
Yeah.
Didn't he say that?
He said it was a real pleasure to meet me and pleasure to sit in the same section. The whole nine yards. It was really an engaging and very fun weekend, despite the heat, despite the rain.
Wow. Well, that's uplifting, man. I'm glad you had such a great weekend. I just did some comedy. I had pretty good shows. I thought
the thing Friday night went really well. Friday morning.
Oh, yeah, it was great at O'Neill's. A lot of people came out. We had some good shows. Mike Birbiglia worked with me all weekend. He's a funny guy.
Yeah.
I alienated him one show, but that was all right. That one show, a couple of Randy's producers came down. I think I got it in my head. You know, Jenny came down with her husband, Gabe, who he's a nice guy.
And they
were hanging out and watching. And it was one of those shows where I just was spiteful. I was spiteful towards the audience, so I gave him a little attitude. And then I look over and I'm like, "Oh, no, they're here. My friends are here." So then about midway through, I tried to shift gears and be a little more congenial. But it turns out that a lot of people don't expect anything different than the attitude from me.
They don't expect congeniality out of you.
I guess not, man. Hey, let's say good morning to San Antonio, Texas.
This is
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley. We're on every weekday there. I'm just introducing myself and my partner here to you. We're on every weekday from 5 to 8 a.m. local time. Our new affiliate is KTXX 103.1 FM.
Yeah!
And they're known as Air America 103.1 San Antonio. I haven't been to San Antonio in a long time. I used to work there. They have a comedy club at the River Center, which is, San Antonio is very interesting. They had this whole
canal thing.
Along the river there. They built up the River Walk and the River Center. I kind of like San Antonio. It's an interesting old Texas city, and there's something about the space in Texas that I kind of like. Maybe it's just because I grew up in New Mexico. I don't know. I like the Southwest. So let's see if we can get into some news a little bit here. First of all, today is the 36th anniversary of the beginning of the Woodstock Festival. So
Woodstock, 1969.
Right on, brothers. Right on. I watched some old Dick Cavett shows because Dick Cavett's going to be on the show later in the week. And they released his Rock Icon series of his shows. And I watched a show with Sly.
And the Family Stone. That must have been cute.
Dude, man. The guy was like, interjecting in the interviews. He looked, I don't know, what was his bag?
Sly was a DJ.
Sly was
an ex-DJ. Had I think, played a little backup with the Bo Brummels.
Right.
One of the early, mid-60s group.
But one of the shows took place on the day that Woodstock ended, I think, or the day of the end. It was Joni Mitchell, Stephen Stills, and David Crosby were on the Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah.
It was like his Woodstock show. And Stills came in. He actually still had mud on his pants from performing up at Woodstock. So that was kind of cool. I'm looking forward to talking to Dick Cavett later in the week, because I got to be honest with you, some of those shows were some of the most uncomfortable television I've ever watched. And I don't think it was intentional.
No, it wasn't.
I don't know if it was the pace of TV, because now you have people who know how to act like an audience. You got a guy out there who's telling them to laugh, telling them to clap, telling them to do everything. And back then, you really had to earn the respect of the audience, and you could feel that on the TV show.
Yeah.
We'll talk to him about it. So the crash of this Helios airline that killed 121 people in Greece has been ruled a non-terrorist related crash. It's bad news, obviously, but it's always better news that it's not somebody blowing up the plane. I feel bad. Do you know exactly what happened? I think there was some sort of decompression problem.
There was some kind of decompression problem in this airplane, and this was, by the way, a Boeing 737, and apparently it flew on autopilot for 3/4 of an hour, and then it slammed into an uninhabited gorge at about 12:03 p.m. local time. 121 people, including 48 youth travelers who were bound for Prague after a stopover in Athens. A real tragedy, but many people are questioning the airline itself. And there was apparently a swarm of Cypriots who descended on the airport and called these people murderers. The people that were involved because
the plane had been broken before, they'd gone unchecked before, and they thought that this plane was damaged and it shouldn't have been flying.
It shouldn't have been flying.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about this. There was a leaked U.S. Department of Homeland Security brief that warned that the U.S. and London are being targeted for attacks by Al-Qaeda using gas tankers as bombs, having suicide bombers driving them into gas stations and other targets on and around the anniversary of 9/11. It's an unconfirmed bit of information. The FBI is not saying that it comes from a valid source, but this brief, I guess, was leaked and it was picked up in England. The document says that Al-Qaeda leaders plan to employ various types of fuel trucks as vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices in an effort to cause mass casualties in the U.S. and London prior to September 19th. And these attacks that they say are planned for specifically for New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. It is unclear whether the attacks will occur simultaneously or be spread over a period of time. The stated goal is the collapse of the U.S. economy. So it's a pretty heinous bit of warning there. But, you know, I don't like reading these stories, Riley, where you read these heinous warnings and these tragic unfoldings, and at the end it says, it's a not confirmed report. We don't know if this information is valid.
Well, part of the problem there, Mark, is that U.S. officials are disagreeing over how important and how serious this is.
Right.
The FBI is saying that this information is not necessarily reliable, while senior intelligence officials are saying it's reliable enough to warrant attention. So we've got our own intelligence gathering communities at loggerheads as to how important this stuff is. Now, what's scary about this, any of you who travel the roads and streets of this and other cities across America, you see these propane, these trucks that are full of propane tanks, and that sort
of
thing.
Oh, yeah, tanks, they're chained onto the trucks in the back.
Well, those are the kinds of things that people are saying could be potential Al-Qaeda targets for hijackings, and then they would run those propane tanks into a gas station with catastrophic results. You could kill 100 people.
I guess they could just steal a gas truck as well, right?
Yeah, gas tanker truck as well.
So let's take the Transportation Security Administration might let us bring our ice picks and box cutters on planes again. God the wait is over. Why did they add that to the list? They're discussing changes, and I guess the changes are around getting people moving to the gates quicker. I don't know if this is an economic for economic reasons to bolster air travel again, but I'm not sure I understand why they are talking about not making you take your shoes off unless you set off the alarm or unless you look like a terrorist, whatever that means. Again, the racial profiling. They're going to talk about allowing scissors, ice picks, and bows and arrows. So the wait is over, folks. You archers,
bows and arrows.
You archers who have been stifled at the gate can now get on with all your machinery. Now, what kind of list is that? Scissors, ice picks, and bows and arrows. Who the hell? What in what world do you need to bring an ice pick on a plane?
By the way, do you know what's still, I guess, prohibited? You know what's prohibited now from bringing lighters? Still, you can't bring a lighter on the plane.
Oh, yeah, my wife is always losing lighters.
Yeah, I mean, like cigar lighters, forget it. And, you know, guys spend a lot of money on those SJ DuPonts and stuff.
Sure,
yeah,
you forget.
Yeah, and you forget, and all of a sudden, you know, what's this in your pocket? And you've suddenly given up $1,000 lighter to somebody.
Unless you want to check it. And they don't have it. It ought to be a reciprocal thing where you give your lighter at the gate in, like, say, in New York, and if you fly in L.A., you're able to pick one up when you leave.
Because
they got boxes of lighters. I don't know what the hell's happening to them all. So today's the deadline for the Iraq Constitution. Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? We're going to talk about that in a second. We're also going to talk about the United States lowering its expectations about the goals of this war based on lies and some of the goals that were not based on lies in terms of democratic progress, evolution of democracy, social change. They're also, you know, giving those up as well. Basically, what I'm saying is they're starting to realize that this war is lost. It's 16 past the hour. We'll tell you about that in a second. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
And don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
The hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
this morning's edition on Air America Radio. Again, want to thank the people that came out to O'Neill's on Friday. Those live shows are really turning into to great events.
Yes,
we're going to be another great live show this Friday when we're going to be up at Amy Ruth's in Harlem.
Yeah,
we'll have pro wrestler Mick Foley, comedian Mike B, and best-selling author Bret Easton Ellis. There'll be free coffee giveaways. It's soul food and sedition, my friends. This Friday morning at Amy Ruth's on 116th Street between 7th and Lenox Avenues from 6 to 9. A.M. So let's get into this Iraq situation. Iraq's leaders wrangled over limits on regional autonomy in what could be the final 24 hours of negotiation about the new constitution. Now, this is touch and go here. President Bush, Riley, obviously pushing to get this thing done on deadline. They're actually considering, you know, cutting the Sunnis out of the process, and they're trying to negotiate some agreement with the Kurds. It's pretty complicated stuff.
It is complicated stuff, but you know what? It really boils down. For the Americans, it's relatively simple. George W. Bush needs this constitutional process to go forward to give the American people the impression that Iraqi democracy is alive and well.
Yeah.
Now, we don't really believe necessarily that Iraqi democracy is alive and well, but they've got a meeting scheduled for 10 a.m. Eastern, Mark, which is 6 o'clock Baghdad time, 6 p.m. Baghdad time. That will determine at that meeting whether or not the Iraqi constitution will go forward. Now, the U.S. ambassador, whose name I can't even pronounce anymore, starts with a K, was quoted yesterday as saying, it's going to happen. I've talked to them. They're going to work it out. But the fact is that the different factions here, the Shiites, the Kurds, and the Sunnis, have competing interests here. The competing interests also involve the Iranians to some extent. It involves the Turks, which nobody talks about because of their interest in what happens in the Kurdish region of northern Iraq.
Right.
And without this whole question of federalism is what the argument's all about.
Well, that's interesting because unbeknownst to most Americans, the neocon death cult is really lowering their expectations of what can actually be achieved in Iraq, like in a big way, my friends. Given that there was no practical plan or vision going in, and certainly none now, they're trying to hide the fact that in a lot of ways, this war is lost, okay? Because, like, look, right now, the U.S. no longer expects to see a model democracy. They don't expect to see a self-supporting oil industry. They don't expect to see a society in which a majority of the people are you know, feel safe and have jobs. I mean, right now, the realities in Iraq are unemployment is at 50 to 65%. A large portion of Iraqis, that's 6 million people, go without electricity. Parents keep their kids inside because they're afraid of kidnappers. Barbers, listen to this, barbers have signs in their windows saying they won't shave men out of fear for their lives from religious extremists. Killings of the Iraqi security force have tripled since January. Convoys out of Turkey, Kuwait, and Jordan, bringing fuel and water and arms and equipment, are attacked like 30 times a week. And it's just, it's ridiculous. Bombings and other kinds of attacks have killed 4,000 civilians in Baghdad since the interim government took office in April. 4,000. And six American GIs were killed, over the weekend.
Just over the weekend. And, Mark, what this all points out is that America tried to do some lifting when they didn't know the weight of the package. They didn't understand that whole idea that American soldiers would have rose petals thrown at their feet when they walked into Baghdad has turned into a 28-month quagmire that these folks now are saying, you know what, our expectations for what we can accomplish here.
Right.
Have to be scaled down. And that's very, very scary stuff because it has implications for Iraqi civilians, 4,000 of which have died since April.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah, exactly. And it, not just scaled down, but, you know, the idea, you know, outside of the lie about weapons of mass destruction, you know, one of the reasons that the neocon death cult said they went into Iraq was to establish a secular, modern Iraq that honors human rights and brings ethnic and religious communities together. But because of their lack of a plan and their complete inability to assess the political situation and the political ambition and momentum of the Shiites and the Kurds, now that they've got to settle for an Islamic Republic.
Well, they've got a couple of choices here, and we're going to know at 10 o'clock Eastern which one they choose. They could extend the deadline. That is a realistic possibility. I'm talking about the National Assembly now. Extend the deadline for getting the Constitution thrashed out. Put off the issues of federalism and women's rights and several of these other issues. Put it off for next year. That's another possibility. The third and probably least likely possibility is that they thrash it all out and get it done by 10 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, and, you know, there's other issues, too, around Iraq is that now, they still don't, our troops still don't have the right armor, right? The Pentagon still hasn't gotten it together to protect our troops with the proper armor. Is that ridiculous? And there's a lot of reasons for this. All right, the ceramic plates in the vests that some of the troops have isn't enough to stop the munitions that insurgents are firing at them. And gunfire apparently has killed about 325 troops. That's about half as many that have been killed by bombs. The military said it has kept the effort to supply the troops with stronger body armor hushed because the insurgency looks for weaknesses and is reading the papers. But I think there's other reasons as well. Now, the thing that complicates why the armor has not been given to them or the proper armor has not been manufactured, there's so many different issues around why they're not producing them quickly. The Pentagon gave one contract to produce plates to a former Army researcher who had never mass-produced anything. And eventually, after 10 months, this is back in March 2003, when the armor problem first became apparent, they give this contract to a guy that's never mass-produced anything, and after 10 months, he gave up. All right, he gave up, and then they couldn't get the plates made on time.
Two words, poor planning. You cannot go into this kind of conflict half-stepping. The insurgents know that the armor plating they had was withstanding the bombs that they used. So you know what they did? They made bigger bombs. See, they're planning. Our people apparently are not planning, and it's costing. It's costing people their lives.
But it's also one of the weird things about, you know, a competitive, privatized army that is, it's one of the liabilities that once you instigate competition between manufacturers, they're going to get greedy, and the people that get hurt are the troops on the ground. We'll be back with the iNews. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
We are going to be talking about Iran in just a second. They're not going to stop processing uranium. They are not going to stop, even though Europe, the European, the EU has tried to get them to stop. They're trying to navigate this. The UN is trying to navigate this. Iran is not going to stop. Bush says, if that's going to be the case, then we might just have to blow you up. I'm paraphrasing. But we'll have the liberal agenda also in just a second. But sometimes, you know, when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily we've got this Wi-Fi 5000 headline translator to help us out here. Let's feed it some headlines. All right, here we go. From CNN, Bush forces last resort on Iran. Bush forces last resort on Iran. Translation. Bush uses vacation to rest up for September Iran invasion. From San Jose Mercury News, GOP lobbyist Abramoff indicted in fraud case. GOP lobbyist Abramoff indicted in fraud case. Translation, Abramoff offers prosecutors nice little trip. From Associated Press, cannabis-based drugs might relieve bowel disease. Where's this going? Cannabis drugs might relieve bowel disease. Translation, relaxed and mellow take on new meanings. Okay. So there's that. So Iran will not stop its conversion of uranium ore despite a request from the International Atomic Energy Agency. They insist that they have the sovereign right under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to convert uranium and do enrichment for peaceful purposes. If that indeed is the case, though, because of this new president and his the possible background that he may have in you know, taking American hostages and being part of the embassy takeover back in, I guess that was, what, 81?
1979.
You know, and also because of the fact that he is, you know, filled his ministries with hardline conservatives. The question is, do we trust them? Does this administration trust them? Does the world trust Iran to use nuclear materials for safe and practical purposes? I don't know. What's real scary to me is George Bush from Texas gets on Israeli TV to make a statement. Does not make a statement to this country in terms of what his thoughts are about Iran. He leaves that up to the American press to trickle down to us, gets on Israeli television and says, all right, if you guys want to play ball, we'll play ball. All options are on the table. You know, I'm not, you know, I'll only use war if I have to, which is a lie. But he basically threatened them on Israeli television. What does that mean, Riley?
Okay, let me explain to you real quickly. First of all, Bush appearing on Israeli television to make this kind of statement, he knows going in is going to infuriate not just the Iranians, but the entire Middle East. The fact that he used Israeli television to make this statement. Now, the next level of this entire battle is, and the thing that a lot of Americans don't understand, is that the Iranians consider the development of nuclear technology to be a point of national honor. Not necessarily to develop a bomb, although there are hardline Iranians that think that this is the ultimate irony here, Mark. In order to protect their oil, they may have to develop some kind of a nuclear capability. Now, and see, it's ironic because it's the oil that makes so many people question why they would need to develop nuclear energy technology. Right. They got all the oil. What do they need nuclear for?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people would want alternative energy resources, but the issue becomes how much does this complicate what's already going on in terms of the alignment between the new Iraqi government and Iran, the alignment between the United States and Israel, the fact that Israel might operate on behest of the U.S. and go in there and bomb these facilities, the idea that George Bush is getting on television in Israel to say, quote, the use of force is the last option for any president. You know, we used force in the recent past to secure our country, end quote, which is a lie. They used force to do what they wanted to do since 1995, using protecting our country as an excuse, not in Afghanistan, but certainly in Iraq. This is a president that will use force, if he feels it, if his gut tells him to.
And he knows going in that doing and saying what he did is a direct provocation to the Iranians. He knows that.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it in his mind. And the Iranians are doing some very interesting triangulation. They continue to say they will negotiate with the European Union while at the same time saying that the United States, who both of whom, by the way, have the same end game, which is to get them to disarm, but that the United States is not able to be negotiated with because of the level of rhetoric that Bush has engendered here. The idea that, hey, if need be, we'll strike you, we'll invade you.
Well, yeah, and let's not forget, there's rhetoric coming from them, too, which is pretty pretty scary. A spokesman for the Iranian government declared that the Iranians have the means to defend themselves should President Bush act on his warning that military force could be a final option if Iran doesn't halt its nuclear program. Now, what does that mean? What does that look like to Iran? I don't even know, but it's scary, especially considering that the troops are so overextended in Iraq now. Recruiting for the army is down. We don't have the troops to accommodate more war, certainly. No one wants more war. So it seems to me that the option he's talking about is bombing the hell out of them.
Well, yeah, and remember, too, that it's not everyone that doesn't want any more war. There is still that cabal of neoconservatives inside the Bush administration that see Iran as the next logical place for America to exert its influence, if need be, its hegemony over the Middle East region. And this is what you find the common thread among all these different nations. They are tired of the West using the pretext of, you know, protecting their own national security to run roughshod over what they see as their own prerogatives.
Yeah, and their own prerogatives involve consolidating the global oil industry, or what's left of it, under the American management. Isn't that sort of part of it?
Well, they want they want control of their own oil.
Mm-hmm.
They believe
the Iranians do.
The entire Middle East,
right?
Does. They want to be able to control how their oil now. You know, theoretically, OPEC is supposed to do this already.
Yeah.
But a lot of these folks are saying, look, the Americans are the ones that dictate, for better or for worse, exactly how the oil market is dealt with, because they have all of this military presence in the Middle East. That's why the Iraqis are furious and had been furious for years about the U.S. military presence in Saudi Arabia. No direct threat to them. But the fact is that as Muslims, they had a problem with, you know, the U.S. building a military installation in a place that they considered a holy site.
Well, it's very interesting about this new president, this Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad is that, you know, it's still not clear whether or not he participated in the embassy takeover in 1979. They've talked to hostages who were there, who were trying to identify him. Some of them can't identify him. I'm not sure what implication that has, other than the fact that this guy is a hardliner. He is, like you said, they see a certain pride in this nuclear program, and that if this is going to be a standoff, if he's going to play chicken with this insane president, with the neocon death cult, who the hell knows what would happen? When are they going to time this thing? I have to assume that given the reaction to Cindy Sheehan's vigil out there in Crawford, Texas, about the resurrection of an active and emotional peace movement in this country, the idea that this neocon death cult, this administration, would actually be considering going into Iran in any capacity, whether it's bombs or troops or whatever, would not just meet the complete horror and disdain of most of this country, 62% of which is already disapproving Bush's handling of the Iraq war, is just, of course, I don't know, Riley, it just scares the hell out of me, but the only hope that I have is that it would definitely sink them.
You've got good reason to be scared, Mark, because any commitment of troops to Iran, whether it be to occupy after bombings, whether it be to be the spearhead of an invasion or whatever, would make the United States a pariah around the world. This would not just be a matter of the Middle East. Europe would turn on the United States for simultaneously occupying Iraq and invading Iran.
And who's to say that not just Europe, but who's to say that somebody wouldn't try to start to finance and feed weapons into the region? If we are going to continue along this road to creating a kind of a Muslim crescent, to creating a regional alliance between countries against us that is organized to, you know, sort of substitute or replace the Cold War, which I think is part of the neocons' agenda, I don't know. I can't even interpret the insanity. But I do know that there is a growing, that the peace movement has been re-energized by Cindy Sheehan, who we're going to talk to. We're going to check in with her every day. We're going to talk to her in just a little while. I was watching one of those Dick Cavett shows that I talked about earlier, because he's going to be on the show later. And on one of these shows, the show that Sly Stone is on, Fred Harris, the senator from Oklahoma, I believe, who was head of the DNC in the 70s, and also his wife was on. She's an Indian activist. But, you know, my family sort of knew them when I was growing up in New Mexico, because that's where they live. But he was interesting because he was talking about what they were calling moral issues at that time. Now, this is towards the end of, it was in 71 or 72.
Really?
So Nixon was still
70s.
President. And he said that the moral issues this country has to face are peace, race, and poverty. Now, that's profound, because those things never went away. Those should still be what our real moral things, moral issues to confront. I mean, those should still be them. How we got to, you know, gay marriage,
abortion.
How did we get there? What the hell happened? And I realized that, you know, in relation to what I heard on that show and what, because I don't remember that. I was, I was 9 years old, is that, you know, what we're seeing now, and for the first time in many years in my memory, and certainly as an adult, is that that because of Cindy Sheehan and because of the emotional grief that she's gone through, she's really resurrected the peace movement that we haven't seen certainly since 9/11, because it sort of got pushed aside by the credibility of the invasion of Afghanistan.
And Cindy Sheehan has ignited something that many people thought would be dormant forever. And that's the thing that is going to, and I believe that that's why so many people, whether it be the guy that fired off a round in the air near her compound, or whether it's the the right-wing gas bags that are continuing to savage her, that's why she's so dangerous to them. Because she had the power. And I don't even think she went into this entire thing believing that she had that power. But she has shown. Do you realize that Crawford Peace House, that Crawford Peace House had had their phone cut off and they had $121 in the bank. Yeah. Now, since Cindy Sheehan showed up, they've paid off a $40,000 mortgage. Now, you don't want to put it in crass financial terms, but the fact of the matter is that being able to pay off that mortgage means that that organization is now viable and is able to continue with its work.
Dude, if we can franchise peace, I'm all about that.
Me too.
And, speaking about, money and the way that money is insidious and the way corporations work, there might be hidden inside every iPod might be a payday for Bill Gates. I'll tell you about that in a second. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Oh, freaking nothing to lose. Makes you laugh at the troubling news. Sometimes I wonder if he's hitting the booze. Oh, freaking king of the Jews.
Air America Radio.
That's great. Oh, my God. It reminds me of when I was a kid, 50 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Reminds me of going to my grandparents' house in Pompton Lakes, New Jersey, Channel 11. Used to do the Three Stooges in the mornings. My grandfather used to love them.
TV, by the way, still does them.
Yeah, I can't remember whether I was a tremendous fan of the Three Stooges when I was a kid. I'm not generally a huge fan of slapstick, but I remember just loving watching it with my grandfather because my grandfather got such a kick out of it that I got a kick out of it. I mean, of course, it's always funny. It was when you're a kid, it's funny.
If you're a boy kid.
I guess so. I can't watch them now, but when I was a kid, I used to watch them and the Dead End Kids, the Bowery Boys were on the same station. I just remember from my past. The reason we played that is Spuds Murphy. What's his first name?
Lyle
Spuds Murphy, the composer of that, just died. Just died a week
August
or so
5th,
ago.
Yeah, he's a very interesting figure. He was a big band arranger for a number of years, and he developed this musical system called the equal interval system that's been used by everybody from Herbie Hancock to all of these composers for film and television. They all use his method of composition. It's incredible.
One of the unsung heroes of competition was the guy that wrote the bit for the Three Stooges.
Absolutely. Died at 96.
Isn't it weird that you just don't know? You don't know these things about people. People have these lifelong things that they do.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to sneeze. I hope I can get...
Bless you.
Thank you. All right, there's the sound of the fax machine from the liberal, from the Streisand compound. Here's,
fax make you sneeze, didn't it?
It did. Here's your liberal agenda marching orders for today. One, if he's convicted, suggest that Jack Abramoff give everyone in America an all-expense-paid golfing trip to Scotland. Two, locate your nearest neighbor named Bush and camp out on his lawn until he answers some tough questions about the war in Iraq. Three, to irritate your conservative boss, show up at the office in a short-sleeved shirt and jeans every day for the next 3 weeks and tell him you're just following the president's example. 4, Arnold Schwarzenegger is raising money for his special election in November by charging people to sit with him in a luxury box for the Rolling Stones concert in Boston. Try to convince the Stones that night to play nothing but Sweet Neocon over and over and over again. All right, here's today's phrase. Just drop this into conversation. Bush says he'll use force against Iran only as a last resort. Wake up, sheeple. Force is his favorite resort. He spends all his long, long vacations there, and we have to tip the housekeepers. Dig that, man. So here's what I was saying about before the break there, this Bill Gates fella. Boy, he's a crafty guy, huh? Apple Computer may be forced to pay Microsoft royalties on every iPod sold, which could run into the hundreds of millions of dollars, Riley. And I just bought one. That means a couple of bucks are going to go into this guy's pocket. And I had some problems with my iPod, and I went down to the Apple store. Why do I get the lemons? Why do I got to get a
lemon?
You're not
the only one.
I know that, but I take it personally. I'm calling my wife. I'm like, this is like my whole damn life, this iPod. You know, I got to go to the Apple store twice to get it fixed. It might be working, but now I don't trust it. You know, I think it's a little crazy. Crazy cats. I got a crazy machine. Everything has to reflect on me. Do you know what I mean? I've decided that my three cats are now perfect manifestations of every part of my personality. Each one has a different part of my personality. And I think it's actually possible. I can't prove it, but let's talk about this. Sorry. Microsoft apparently beat out Apple in the development of a software that's used in the iPods. When Apple introduced the iPod in November 2001, it didn't fill out a provisional patent application until July 2002. Now, the full application apparently was filed in October of 2002, and Microsoft submitted an application in May 2002 to patent some key elements of the music player, including the song menu software. Now, apparently, they might be able to get royalties on licensing.
$10 a throw for each and every iPod sold.
God, can you even imagine the money? What the hell you do with that kind of money and the amount of vision and crafty capitalist thinking that this guy did?
He who hesitates is lost.
But just the licensing, just the idea that every computer, almost every computer for any reason made, is going to have some element of Microsoft in there.
Yeah.
And that they're going to make, it's like water. They're going to make money off of technological water.
Why don't we make Gates president?
What are you crazy?
Anybody that could do something and create something that virtually every American who has a computer has to interact with is, to me, an extraordinary person. Now, I'm not saying that he's a good person, but it's extraordinary that you can insert yourself that deep. I mean, it's like scotch tape.
I don't know what kind of person he is. I mean, he's obviously done some great stuff. If you go to Seattle, you know, yeah, and you see what, you know, the face of that city now. Now, a lot of people will have problems with Gates, and a lot of people think that he's turned Seattle into an overpriced, you know, a playground for rich techno people.
Tree huggers.
Right. Well, no. But there's a balance there that, you know, they can't deny the fact that he has done some good things. You know, he has done some.
He's put up a humongous amount of money to put young black children in math programs through college.
Yeah, some of the philanthropies. Well, that's the catch with anybody who has that kind of money or anyone that is that powerful a person, is that they do all these things that are questionable, and they make everything, they level the playing field and make everything the same on some level. They mediocritize things, yet they do these other things that help the planet. You know, that's how they balance their, you know, thank God for rich people's guilt, or I think most charities would go unfunded.
I don't know. Is Bill Gates all that different, for example, than Andrew Carnegie, who was, a guy who, in creating Big Steel, was ruthless in terms of his workers, but also created Carnegie Mellon University and Carnegie Hall and, you know, funded the arts and all the rest. Is Bill Gates really all that different from Carnegie?
Well, I don't think he's ruthless. I think he's ruthless in business practices, but apparently he's the number one philanthropist in the world. I know that the people that work for him are given an in-house health coverage that is excellent.
Yeah. Second to none.
That, you know, and they have, they have stock options. It really becomes about, does he level competition to the point where the little guy can't make a break? So on that level, being that type of ruthless capitalist, certainly he's guilty of some transgressions, but I don't think he was out killing people.
Is Apple a little guy?
Apple was an underdog to a certain degree, but there are even literal guys, smaller people, that are just caught in the tidal wave of Microsoft. When we come back, obviously, we're going to be talking to Cindy Sheehan a little later. We're going to get back into Iraq and just the fact that, it's taken so long to get armor to some of the troops, and a lot more. It's 57 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hey!
We're back from the weekend. Hope you're having a decent Monday. We're trying to readjust. I got a little air conditioner cold going. Everyone got a cold. I hate these summer colds, but they always fly around. You having some grape soda there, Pops?
Absolutely. Wake me right up.
Man, Riley's back from Foxborough. We went to the big drum corps semifinal national thing. What was it?
Semifinals and finals. The world championships.
And he got recognized in the stands. Someone comes up to Pops Riley and says, "Are you Mark Riley from Morning Sedition?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Yes, I am." And he goes, "It's an honor to sit behind you."
Yay.
That's it.
Honor to make your acquaintance.
That's nice.
It was cool.
It's very nice. I did some comedy. I spent some time with my cats. And then I got this damn cold yesterday because Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, brings the virus into the studio and announces it last week. And I hate that. I hate when you work with somebody and just like, "I'm sick." And I'm like, "Oh, great. So now we're all sick. Great. Okay, so that's good." But there was some good news. Kalo is on vacation. That's not the good news. We've got Tim the librarian. How are you, buddy? Do you have to say anything? I know it makes you uncomfortable. Yeah. But Dan Pashman, do you want to come in here and tell us how you did this? Dan Pashman got engaged.
What are you bringing him in here?
He got engaged.
You can talk about the engagement part.
I'm not going to
bring him in here because he's got a virus.
No, he's just, he's better, of course.
Oh, yeah.
But he got engaged, and dig this, Riley, no ring. You know,
I only thought News Daddy got away with that.
No ring. So, how did it unfold, Dan? What went down?
We're in somewhat unorthodox situation, but I proposed to her on the Brooklyn Bridge.
You don't look orthodox.
On the Brooklyn Bridge, walking across it.
Exactly.
Well, and you knew you were going to do it. When did you know you were going to do it? When did you know?
I guess I kind of decided it several weeks ago, probably at the end of July.
Yeah.
And then I was going to tell my brother on Tuesday when I saw him, but I got like a last second cold feet, and I said I'm going to sleep on it one more day before I make it official. And then Wednesday I made it official.
Yeah, when I got engaged to this wife, my second wife,
right.
The first wife, I bought a ring and I did the whole number. And and with Mishna, we were in Italy and we were at a lovely restaurant. And I didn't have a ring with me.
Right.
I didn't have anything with me, and I knew I needed to marry her. And I said, maybe we should talk about getting married. That was my proposal. Pretty lame, right?
Yeah, that's pretty romantic.
Hey, nothing's lame if it works. Right?
But I should say, I don't want to make it sound like I didn't give her anything. We're both people who enjoy experiences more than stuff.
Yeah.
So I told her, for our engagement, instead of a ring, I would take her anywhere in the world that she wants to go.
Well, just remember, as you get older, if you do spend your life with this woman, as the experiences begin to fade and decay with the brain, it's always nice to have a ring to look at.
Well, we're going
to
get them.
Yeah, right?
We're going to get some kind of a ring on our trip.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
You never had any question that she was going to say yeah, did you?
Maybe I had a 2% question, but I was pretty confident. But, we've only been going out for 10 months, so I wanted to, some people wait so long to propose that by the time they propose, it's kind of a foregone conclusion. I wanted there to be a little excitement, a little drama,
So, Bashman, I think we're going to, where is she going, your new fiance?
She's leaving actually in 2.5 weeks. She's moving to Slovakia.
See, I know how this works. See, I know how the brain works. I understand timing. Uh-huh. I got married before I moved here to take this job, and you got engaged just to sort of protect yourself a little bit. She's going out into the world. I've heard that Slovakian men very compelling.
Well, you're right to a point. Although I would put it in a slightly more romantic terms.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to make it clear that, that I would still be here when she came back.
Oh, yeah. Well, translation too. I wanted to make it clear that you're mine.
That's right.
You are mine.
I put a spell on you.
Well, congratulations. Now
thanks,
your cold.
Yeah.
You already ruined
nice
my
work,
week.
Man.
I'm doing the zinc thing, man.
Coldies.
No, I'm doing the quantum zinc, and I'm doing it every 2 hours. I'm following the directions because I want to know if it works. And so far, I don't know. Because now we know echinacea is bad.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. But this cold thing, you swear by the zinc.
I swear by the zinc,
but I expect it to stop it altogether.
No, what happens is you start to feel a little more sick.
Yeah.
You feel it coming on.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you skip to the part where you're starting to feel better. And you never get the "I am 100% sick, full-blown cold."
Okay.
That is what happens with the zinc.
Well, this is very powerful stuff. We'll be reporting on it throughout the week. I'll let you know how that story progresses. 36 years ago today was the first day of the Woodstock Festival. 300,000 people covered in mud and tripping on acid watched Hendrix, Joe Cocker, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Santana in upstate New York. Oh, that would have been fun, wouldn't it? Do you remember it?
I wasn't there. My sister went. I did not.
Did you have a good time?
She had a ball. See, the problem was, your good time was really determined by how close to the actual stage you got. Because some people ended up in Kingston and couldn't get any closer.
And whether or not the strange dancing hippie guy next to you, you know, didn't throw
freak out on you. Yeah.
Have you ever had shows ruined by throwing up people? I have. I really have. There was one time.
Several.
You know what? I'm rambling. Right, I'm not 66 years ago today was the premiere of The Wizard of Oz. That changed the face of culture. Now let's get into a little bit of news. The crash of the Helios airliner that killed 121 people was not a terrorist-related act. And also, I wanted to talk a little bit about this. You know, we do have Cindy Sheehan coming up in the next hour, and, you know, a lot of people have gone down to Crawford, Texas to stand vigil with her. People from around the world, as it seems, hundreds of protesters have converged on Crawford. Cindy Sheehan has galvanized the peace movement in a way that I've never actually seen myself. She has personified the human cost of war in a way that hasn't been really seen or supported, you know, in years. Even though there has been considerable attention paid to Cindy. Much of it is at the behest of others who want to help, like PR people, journalists, political operatives. Most people seem to be coming because it resonates with them personally. And it's a very moving situation that's going on down there. There are some counter-protests. There has apparently a guy from across the way shot off his shotgun into the air and said, hey, we're in Texas, you just do that. And then there's some people driving by blaring country music. But all in all, there's been, it seems like, a lot of respect for what is going on down there, and we're going to check in with her in a little while. Also, here in New York City, there's an ever-increasing chance of being caught on camera. New York Civil Liberties Union is collecting data on the proliferation of surveillance cameras in public places here in New York City. Police here in New York regularly, apparently, use security camera tapes from you know, corporate headquarters, from privately owned places to help them solve crimes. And this is seen as sort of a justification for putting more cameras out there. Apparently, there are 6,000 cameras in the subway system in London that help them get those tapes that we saw of those bombing suspects.
You remember that situation not far from here a while back where somebody blew up a package?
In front of the embassy?
Yeah, and a planter. Now, they supposedly had security camera footage of that guy.
That was the English embassy,
yeah,
right? The British embassy.
Yeah.
And a guy, they think it was, they might have, to, they thought it was just this biker. This,
yeah.
But they didn't catch the guy, apparently.
They didn't catch him, but they supposedly had him on camera.
You're on camera everywhere. In New York City, as of 1998, there were 2,397 cameras counted by the New York Civil Liberties Union. This time, after canvassing less than a quarter of the borough of Manhattan, they've counted more than 4,000.
Yes.
And this is privately owned, publicly owned, just all the cameras all together. And I think the concern with the New York Civil Liberties Union comes around how high-tech and how these digital cameras, some of them are very small, some of them you can't see, some of them can store thousands of images. How intrusive are they? And also, who can you trust with these images? You know?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of things. Whenever there's this kind of issue, people on both sides can cite extremes. For example, there was a situation that the New York Civil Liberties Union cites where earlier this year a police videotape captured a suicide at a housing project that later turned up on a pornographic website.
I saw that in the article. I'm like, what kind of pornographic website is that? I mean, who would go to a pornographic website where they got
to
a
watch
guy
a suicide, right?
Blowing his brains out, like, oh, yeah, that's great. What is that?
I have no idea. But see, one of the things that people don't talk about here is the fact that this information is often shared with the police. If the cops are looking for somebody where there may have been a video image, even if it's privately owned, they will go. And in most cases, the private people that own these security cameras will cooperate.
Yeah, but what, you know, the scary thing about this is who knows where that information is? Who can you trust with video images? What if, you know, what if they're just, I just think that, okay, I'll be honest with you. People should be able to get away with some stuff. You can't, you know, you can't ruin the game all the way down to the last, you can't fix it like that.
It's a double-edged sword no matter how you look at it. One of the things that a lot of substantial videotaping made a difference in were those people that got busted at the Republican convention here in New York last year, because there was video footage taken of many of those arrested that showed they weren't doing anything but walking down the street, and the cops just grabbed them and swept them up. So those people were freed. Now, that wasn't, not handheld, stationary security cameras. This was mostly people walking around with video
cameras. So in some cases, it can function to protect people as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about what's going on in Iraq, why the war is failing. I want to get into a little more detail around this armor story in terms of why they haven't been able to effectively armor the troops. And it really is the Pentagon's fault. It really is Donald Rumsfeld's fault. The idea of privatizing the war and encouraging free market tactics to make armored Humvees and armored vests really stifled getting these this type of equipment to the troops and cost a lot of Americans their lives. And we'll get into that when we come back at 16 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Wake up, sheeple. It's Monday. Sorry, but you got to do it again. You got to do another week of this. Look, you know, we're going to be talking to Cindy Sheehan in just a little while. We've got Morning Remembrance with Mort Mortensen coming up. Jim Walcott is in the wings from Vanity Fair. You might enjoy reading his columns or his blog or his book, but he's going to be here with us to talk about, among other things, the infighting amongst conservative television pundits, which is just beautiful. Right now, we know a lot of people out there are out of work and spent a lot of time maybe leafing through the Sunday papers, looking at want ads. We want to help. We want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So here's our Morning Sedition Monday job, listening. Listening, that would be, wow. Wanted, vacationing president decoy. The United States government is immediately seeking applicants for the position of vacationing president decoy. The main goal of this position will be to distract attention away from the real president while the real president is busy not being a real president. Duties will include carelessly speeding past wooden crosses and middle-aged mothers in a black Chevy Suburban SUV with tinted windows. However, should the occasion force itself, the successful applicant must be prepared to converse intelligently with angry, heartbroken families while the real president sneaks off to meet Republican donors and Colombian drug lords. In addition, while addressing grieving families, the ideal decoy must be willing to use terms other than mom, toots, and weepy face. Special consideration will be given to applicants who know the difference between real tumbleweeds and Nerf weeds constructed by the Secret Service. As with all government jobs, this position will include a considerable pay, a considerable per diem allowance for having sex with the First Lady.
Ooh.
The preceding announcement was approved by Dick Cheney. Let's get into this real quick because I want to, get a nice ease into to Jim Walcott to discuss why these conservative pundits are starting to feed on themselves, which is beautiful. But I said I was going to talk about this body armor. I want to talk about the body armor and the reason why the troops don't have up to date body armor can directly be blamed on the neocon death cults. Donald Rumsfeld for insisting that this privatized war, the idea, first of all, that a streamlined army could do, a streamlined set of military forces could achieve what they set out to achieve in Iraq, which was, based on lies, but the idea that they could just, bring in a democracy and make that happen is falling apart. But also the privatizing and instigating competition on behalf of military contractors has, killed American soldiers, all right? Yeah, it could still take several months to get them the proper armor that they need. And some of these delays are because the Pentagon relied on a small group of four small armor makers with limited production capacity. Each company had to come up with their own designs, and then that had to be approved by the Pentagon after testing. All right? And the main ingredient in these in this armor are ceramic plates. And that's in short supply, despite a federal initiative to kick the industry in the pants and get up to meeting demand. And now they need to enhance these plates. And the whole problem is that all this stuff is being stopped because they're trying to initiate, competition among contractors. They're using several different contractors, and these contractors have to design their own vests. And then when the military says, we want to buy the design, one of these contractors said, well, I don't know how much you got. And they balked at selling the design out of greed, and people are dying.
What's amazing about this, Mark, is that there was already, and you know, because, and I think most of our listeners know, that there was a soldier who confronted Donald Rumsfeld on this very issue. He was talking about armor for the Humvees, okay, not too long ago. And there were changes promised in the way the Defense Department did its business so that all American soldiers would have adequate armor. We now see that they changed nothing. We now see that the procurement process is part of the problem, because the procurement process is what gives license to people to decide, well, okay, we can deal with someone who's never dealt with this before.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's crazy.
We can deal with these sorts, and it happens across the board. Whether it's an event planner who was working out of her house before she got a huge contract on the one hand, or these little armor companies that had never done this kind of work before and yet still got these big contracts, and now they're saying, we're working as fast as we can.
Yeah, and people are dying because of this. A lot of people are dying because the insurgents' munitions are pounding through, you know, these outdated vests that they have. You remember there were people collecting vests from police departments and sending them over. Parents were sending their kids who were fighting the proper equipment they needed. And now, on top of everything else, the vision for Iraq on behalf of the U.S. this administration, the neocon death cult, and some officials are starting to say that, look, they no longer expect to see a new model democracy. They no longer just expect to see a self-supporting industry, oil industry. They no longer expect to see a society in which a majority of the people feel safe and have jobs. I mean, they're giving up because they got into a war that had no end. It barely had a beginning, and people are dying every day. More and more, it's escalating. And it was all based on a lie, and now even the things that they used to cover up the lie, the idea that they would just set up a Western-style democracy, that's falling apart. And now there's a feeding frenzy, or not a feeding frenzy, but the conservative pundits are starting to eat themselves. Apparently, you know, Bill O'Reilly expressed dissatisfaction at Donald Rumsfeld. Ann Coulter expressed dissatisfaction at Bill O'Reilly. And now that, you know, because of the conflicting messages coming out of this, you know, chaotic and corrupt organization that is the administration, it's starting to trickle down into their minions.
Ain't it fine?
Yeah, I think it's great, you know, and I'm gonna be interested to see what Jim Walcott has to say about some of that stuff going on the tube, and we'll ask him some other stuff as well about maybe the media handling of the Cindy Sheehan event, who we are going to be talking to, a little more than a half hour, probably in the next hour. We're going to talk to Cindy, see how things are going. We've also got someone to talk about, you know who Joel Osteen is? That insane sort of like frightening preacher that you see on television. We've got a guy who wrote a big piece on him for Texas Monthly. Our 8 o'clock hour, last hour, is going to be all about Texas. It's 27 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Wake up, sheeple. It's Monday. Hope things are okay. It's a little rainy here. I don't know how it is where you are. I want to welcome San Antonio aboard the great Morning Sedition ship. We are going out to KTXX 103.1 FM. They are known as Air America 103.1 San Antone. We're in Texas. The next hour of this show is going to be dedicated to Texas,
because
we're going to be talking to Cindy Sheehan out there at the Crawford Ranch and see how things are going with her. We're also going to be talking to journalist William Martin, who just wrote a big Texas Monthly piece about Houston preacher Joel Osteen. And right now in our studio, we are happy to welcome back one of our favorite guests. He's a contributing editor for Vanity Fair. He's also the author of Attack Poodles and Other Media Mutants, The Looting of the News in a Time of Terror. You can also go to his website, www.jameswolcott.com. Good morning, James Wolcott. How are you?
Not bad at all, considering the hour.
Good morning.
The darkness, too.
Well, I'm glad you're here. You know, we like to talk to you, and we want to hear, what do you think, what is your reaction to how the media is handling the Cindy Sheehan event? Because we are talking to her every day. Mm-hmm. How is the right wing handling it? Is there a left wing media? We know how we're handling it. Why don't you give us a story on that?
Well, the right wing media, they're cranking up everything they can. I mean, they're really trying all the old slime tactics. I don't think they're working this time. I mean, that's the impression I get. I mean, but I noticed that you can tell she's really getting to people, because there are right-wing bloggers who are normally considered the more moderate ones, the more sensible ones, and they're flipping out.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it's like they're using language like kook and crank and showboat and, you know, and...
For who?
Against Cindy Sheehan.
No kidding.
Yeah, and see, I think part of it, too, is it's not just that she's hit a nerve. It's also that there's they won't acknowledge it. A lot of men hate it when they're questioned by a woman.
Right.
You know, oh, it's this thing of like, you know, who is this woman raising this question? You see it all the time with whistleblowers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many of the whistleblowers are women, and there's a male attitude of like, well, what is he nagging me about? But one of the things I noticed yesterday was watching the Sunday morning talk shows. Mm-hmm. When they would bring up Cindy Sheehan, they did it in a kind of grudging way, sort of like,
do I have to?
Do I, you know, Senator, I feel I must ask you, there's a woman in Texas named Cindy Sheehan, and you really felt like their heart wasn't in it, but they
right.
felt they should deal with it. I think what she's done is very interesting, and I think you're going to see more smearing from Fox News and all that. But I don't think it's going to make a difference.
But how far can they really? I mean, what's the extent of the smear? I mean, she's not whether or not she's you know self-promoting or whether or not you know they're accusing her of being a showboat. That's not the issue. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the emotional roots of this. Mm-hmm. Are probably, I mean, as you said, are there some conservatives that have not taken that path in slandering her?
Well, they take a more moderate path of feeling like she has her pain,
okay.
But Bush has his reasons for not doing it. But I think that they're in a real trap now because the fact is the visuals are against them.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know, A, Bush is on a long vacation.
Yeah.
A long one.
Yeah.
Secondly, we know he's doing bike rides and he's doing fundraisers.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bush can't claim, I'm in a lockdown mode.
Right.
This is an intense time for the country and I simply don't have the time. We know he's got all the time in the world because yesterday he did a 2-hour bike ride with Boy Scouts. And this is the one where Bush made his, I think it's going to be an immortal statement, that he wants to get on with his life.
Okay.
I mean,
what does that even mean?
Well, you know, I was thinking that's the kind of thing actresses say after there's a porn tape released about them. You know, and they're on Larry King. Well, you know, Larry, it was very distressing, but now I want to get on with my life. You know, or somebody's just gotten out of prison. You know, the 2 years I spent. I mean, they were tough, Larry, but now I really want to get on. You know, and it's like, what does Bush have to get on to?
Right.
He acts like he's the victim.
That's true. And it's amazing how he's found some success in that with people mm-hmm. who are extremely right-wing.
James Walcott, I know from talking to some of these folks that the conservative gas bags that we see on TV on a mm-hmm. regular basis don't always like each other as a group. They mm-hmm. will criticize each other out of camera range.
Mm-hmm.
But now it seems that some of this stuff is starting to get in camera and microphone range, and maybe some of these right-wing pundits are eating themselves. Is that possible?
Well, I think you're seeing some of it on Iraq, and I think what's happening is you're starting to see a real split now between the Bush loyalists, the super Bush loyalists, mm-hmm. and the people who have a hold on reality. You know, and there are some conservatives who recognize it's really not going well in Iraq, and we can't send the troops back for a third rotation.
Right.
We've got to start. But then you have the super loyalists who will never acknowledge it, and they're like Bush. They're the ones who keep saying, we have to be steadfast, we have to show resolve, you know, we cannot waver. And so what you're seeing now is the break between the people who realize, no, it really has gone bad, and the ones who say, how can you say that? We must never show. And so, you know, that's where you get an Ann Coulter on one side. Or yesterday on the Fox News panel, Bill Kristol will not admit that, you know, he's, in fact, Bill Kristol, they're blaming Rumsfeld now.
Mm-hmm.
They're
yeah.
saying,
he should be blamed, that guy.
Oh, he should. But yeah. In a strange way, they're making Rumsfeld the weak dove. They're saying, in effect, Rumsfeld, he won't prosecute the war the way Bush wants. And it's like, what
does he want?
What phantom army do we
have? Have you noticed that about these guys, this neocon death cult, this administration, that they'll put out several different people saying several different mm-hmm. things to confuse the media waters, and then, like, everybody, no, there's no barometer of truth to any of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, they roil it up that way, but also they prevent any, like, more leftist viewpoint. I mean, we're at a point now where it's like the media is so right-wing that it's right-wings arguing with right-wingers arguing with each other,
right?
Rather than anybody from a more from an you know another perspective. So it's sort of like within it's almost like a family feud for a lot of them.
I get it.
What do you make of the reports that we're seeing today that the military and the Bush administration have lowered expectations about what can be done in Iraq? We're less than 3 hours now away from a deadline where the Iraqis are supposed to have developed a constitution. All indicators, except for the U.S. ambassador, seem to think that's not going to happen. What do you make? I mean, is it Cindy Sheehan? Is she scaring these people to the point that they're now saying, well, you know, the Iraqis are just going to have to live with 65% unemployment?
No, I don't think it's Cindy Sheehan. I really think it's the troops in the field, and I think it's the officers. I think they're coming back and saying, we can't hold this together much longer. I think it's because they know that the sophistication of the bombs is getting better. You know, and even when there's a lull, when the lull is over, the next wave of attacks is even harder and harsher and takes more people. I mean, we lost 7 soldiers over the weekend. Mm-hmm. And that sort of gets lost. I think it's what's coming back from the commanders in the field. They're saying, we cannot hold this together much longer. And then the political people are trying to say, okay, but we've got to, like, make it look like it's smooth, like we're doing a smooth segue out. And so that way we're going to lower expectations. Because you'll notice Bush talks about it a little bit, but people aren't using the words victory anymore. Victory over the insurgent.
Oh, that's for sure.
You know, the victory word is gone. Because remember, they were saying, we don't have an exit strategy. We have a victory strategy.
Oh, now they're saying that. They're basically saying in no fewer words that, you know, we're trying to cut our losses here.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking to James Walcott. Now, this month is historically not a very active news month in the media, but it has been incredibly active. And it's weird when you see all this news coming down this summer. How are the media outlets handling that? I mean, are they disappointed? Would they rather be doing beach stories? And I guess they have one with that girl in Aruba.
Story. Well, I think now they're kind of used to it. I think now because of everyone's got their laptops, I think they're sort of more used to the fact that, oh, we're always going to have something going, no matter what, even during the downtime. The difference is normally in a downtime like this, there wouldn't be any political stuff. It would be all Natalie Holloway. And, of course, if on certain stations, it is all Natalie Holloway. But I think everyone's sort of more aware because they're all sort of they're like plugged in. Also, for this year, we've had a lot of strange things coming up on deadline in August. Mm-hmm. You know, the pullout from Gaza and the Constitution. So that builds this sort of, I mean, I don't know why you'd want to do a constitution on a deadline.
Right.
A term paper.
Because they need the publicity. They need the excuse to get out. They need to say, like, okay, that's done. Now we can do this.
Well, also, I think they felt like if we don't give them a deadline, they're going to haggle this for like 5 years.
Right.
You know, they're just going to be just sitting around because it's very hard to agree on these things anyway. Yeah. They may come out with a constitution that's just so vague and so, you know, just
that's
so
not going to solve anything.
No, it won't solve anything.
So what's the I don't mean to shift gears too dramatically, but is the right-wing media outlets having any success in demonizing the Rolling Stones, Jim?
Well, I you know, Fox News has been hilarious about this because, first of all, the other day they referred to the Rolling Stones as part of the Hollywood left. Mick and Keith
are like, British.
But then they even topped that, which is they had a statement from the Oak Ridge Boys. Now,
are you serious?
The Oak Ridge Boys, they interviewed them. The Oak Ridge Boys, their collective age must be what, like 150, right?
Who the hell cares about the Oak Ridge Boys?
Well, and the Oak Ridge Boys were saying that they just feel like there's no reason for Mick and Keith. I mean, we love the Rolling Stones, but there's no reason for them to do that
to
at this time.
President.
And then the Fox host said, and you know, the Oak Ridge Boys are also going around the country teaching school children the lyrics to Star Spangled Banner because they realize that practically no one knows the lyrics.
But everybody knows the lyrics to Elvira. Right.
So they're trying with that. But, you know, the thing is, the Rolling Stones... And actually, David Crosby made a very good point about this on a TV show. He said, the Dixie Chicks got what they got because Clear Channel was against them.
Right.
You know, that radio, you know, you're not seeing that now. It's just the right-wing press. You're not seeing a radio or a commercial, because you're not going to have a commercial boycott of the Rolling Stones.
Of course not.
No.
I mean, it's music. It's just
sort
of like, it's the Stones. I'll tell you that, Crosby, mm-hmm. he's got some nads, that guy. I was watching these old Dick Cavett shows. Have you got that? He's released some of these rock icon shows, and even then, when Crosby was on the Cavett show, he's like, hey, man, if we can just get all these automobile manufacturers to shut down, GE, Chrysler, we would make the air breathable. And Cavett was hilarious. He's like, well, those were two of my sponsors. And that's a weird question I want to ask you, because I'm going to be talking to Dick Cavett later in the week. And do you find that, like, I'm watching these old shows, and they are awkward. I mean, some of them are very uncomfortable because I believe it's the audience didn't know how to act like an audience yet. Now they're primed. They're made to laugh. They laugh on purpose.
Right.
And literally, when you watch some of that older television, these guys had to earn those laughs.
Well, I remember, are you talking about Cavett or the guests? Because I remember when...
I'm talking about Cavett's show in general.
Yeah, because I remember when... Well, also, the Cavett show had a lot of tension. You know, when he did it in New York, he would have people on like I.F. Stone, and they would talk about Vietnam, and you'd hear people shouting from the balcony.
So it was a pretty racy program. See, I guess I'll talk to him about the history of it, but because I didn't remember it. It was a weekly program, I guess, and I was too young.
Oh, no, it was nightly. Well, the beginning, Cavett was nightly.
First was nightly.
Yeah, he was nightly up against Carson.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a lot of shows out of New York, and there was much more friction, and it was not canned the way, like, when you go in and see a Letterman audience now, and, you know. No, there was a lot more tension in the air. Also, so the range of guests was different.
Yeah, well, we're going to have Dick Cavett on later in the week, so look forward to that. I'm looking forward to talking to him because he did do some very compelling TV. We have Jim Walcott here. What are you working on for the magazine right now? What's coming up for you?
I'm working on a column on why they're going after PBS, you know, and NPR, the political neutering of PBS and NPR by the Bush administration.
Oh, that's great. That's great. We talk about that a lot on the air. Looking forward to that.
Maybe we'll have you on that now.
So we'll probably talk to you in a couple of weeks. The website is www.jameswalcott.com. The book, Attack Poodles and Other Media Mutants. Look for his piece in Vanity Fair. Great talking to you, Jim. Come back and see us another time.
Sure. 47
past the hour. We'll be back with the Morning Remembrance. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Mark Maron's mom, and you're listening to my son and his friend Mark Riley. They're very good boys. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Two past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Wake up, sheeple. It's Monday. Sorry about that, but it'll be okay. Cindy Sheehan coming up shortly. Right now, unfortunately, it's that time of week again when we here at Morning Sedition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
You all right?
Morning, guys.
Yeah, how are you, buddy? Nice to see you, Mort.
Just start right off here.
Okay.
Dan Taylor, builder of submarines to search for the Loch Ness Monster. Dan Taylor, a man who spent the past 30 years building his own submarines in the hopes of finding the Loch Ness Monster, has died after realizing what a monstrous waste of time his life was.
Oh, man.
At age 10, Taylor built his first submersible from an old wine barrel. The resulting three-day drunk was sadly the only time he's ever come close to seeing a giant serpent.
Yeah. You all right?
Yeah, I'm all right.
All right, buddy.
Taylor financed his last submarine's construction himself, using money from the sale of a failed tunneling rocket he was building to bore to the center of the Earth and take pictures of a race of highly advanced mole people.
Wow.
That's sad.
Yeah.
He is survived by his wife, Nessie, I mean, Margaret. Oh, boy. Oh, you got a new hairspray?
Yeah, I've been wearing this new hairspray. I know you'd be allergic to it.
Very allergic. You look good though.
Oh, thanks, man. So do you, buddy. I wish you weren't so sad.
Not sad. I got allergies.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
W. Pauline Nicholson, Elvis Presley's chef. W. Pauline Nicholson, the cook who prepared Elvis Presley's favorite dishes, has left the mortuary. Nicholson died last month of shock after catching the ghost of Elvis stealing food from her refrigerator. Hired in the mid-60s as a cook and house cleaner, Nicholson quickly grew to affectionately call her boss Mr. P, long before she even knew what his last name was. I got five more.
Keep going.
The legendary singer soon became an ardent admirer of her peanut butter and fried banana concoctions. So much so, he surprised one of the sandwiches with a pink Cadillac. he was insane by that time.
Yeah, crazy, I guess.
Nicholson finally recalled how Elvis would sometimes talk with her in the kitchen at Graceland, in between gulping downers and trying to deport the Beatles.
Oh, no. All right.
Yeah, I'm fine.
All right, buddy.
Nicholson's cooking was so good, the king reportedly found it hard to pass on any of her dishes until that fatal day in 1977 when he tried to pass her meatloaf.
Oh, boy, you proud of yourself?
You should be.
You need a Kleenex?
Yeah, it's really...
Big one.
Oh, thanks, man.
Sure, buddy.
Where am I?
Towards the end there.
The deceased requested her body be fried in butter and served to the ghost of Jerry Garcia. He was another fat guy.
Yeah, he's fat. He's fat, and he liked a different, whole different...
type of music.
Yeah. Type of music and type of drug.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. We all have our own drugs, don't we?
Yeah, we do. We do. Not so many for me anymore.
For me, it's just the life.
Oh, that's very touching.
Anyway, this has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying... Who's chopping onions?
Oh, man. Wow, Mort. So, that's a big weekend with Elvis's cook dying and everything.
Anyway, you know, I left out one joke. You want me to?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, that's not.
We got time.
No, we don't have time.
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
If you do it today.
No, that's okay. Now the whole setup's screwed up. Doesn't matter.
Really? You think you undermine the bit by breaking character and calling them jokes?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought that.
I'll just leave that for the book.
Why don't you? All right, we got Cindy Sheehan coming up. Thank you. It's nice to see you, Jim. I'm glad you're well. Cindy Sheehan is going to be talking to us from Crawford, Texas, which should be... I can't wait to actually talk to her and see what's going on out there, because we heard rumors about guys shooting up guns and some counter-protests. It's 57 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. Good morning, folks. Six past the hour. The reason we're playing Willie Nelson's version of San Antonio Rose is because, by virtue of coincidence, this next hour is going to be very, very Texas-centric.
Texas-y.
Well, we're going out. First of all, we're going out to, and I happen to love this part of the song, actually. It's kind of a groovy version of it. You know, I Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys did the instrumental version, which I love. And then, like, I was digging through my Willie Nelson records. It's on some Rarities album. He kind of kicks it up a little bit. You know, he kind of glitzes it up, jazzy.
It's got like a rhythm and blues thing going on.
It definitely does got some jump blues kind of feel to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Well, anyways, we are going out to San Antonio as of this morning. So good morning, San Antonio. This is Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Good morning.
We're going to be on there every weekday from 5 to 8 a.m. local time. Our new affiliate is KTXX 103.1 FM. They're known as Air America 103.1 San Antonio. We are also going to be talking to Cindy Sheehan in just a couple of minutes, and later in this hour, we're going to be talking to journalist William Martin about Houston preacher Joel Osteen. A couple other little details I need to get out at you. We are going to be doing our live broadcast this Friday from Harlem at Amy Ruth's.
Yeah, yeah.
That's up on 116th Street between 7th and Lenox Avenues. Got some free coffee. I'm sure there's going to be some great food. 6 to 9, we're going to have Mick Foley down there, comedian Mike B, and Bret Easton Ellis, the author, is going to be with us.
American Psycho, Bret Easton Ellis?
That's exactly who. That's exactly who it's going to be. Now, look, you know, we've heard some stuff about what's going on there out in Crawford with Cindy Sheehan's vigil. The protest is amassing people. Hundreds of protesters are converging on Crawford from around the country. There's been some reports that a neighbor fired off a couple of shotgun blasts into the air, and another counter-protester was driving around, I guess, in the middle of the night, blaring country music. And there was a statement released by Cindy Sheehan and the moms out there on the on outside of the Crawford Ranch about the shotgun blast from the neighboring ranch. Let me quote that from her blog, I believe. At around 10:30 a.m. Crawford time this morning, a shotgun shot rang from a neighbor's ranch in Crawford. Cindy Sheehan and several other mothers who have lost their sons in Iraq have been working with the Secret Service and the law enforcement to ensure that events at Camp Casey, which is what they're calling it now, remain calm and peaceful. Quote, we want to be clear that there have been no infringements on this person's property, and we have remained at a safe distance. We have maintained and will continue to maintain a peaceful presence in Crawford until the president agrees to meet with Cindy. As to the neighbor's suggestions that we go home, we suggest he talk to his permanent neighbor, President Bush. We are not leaving until President Bush meets with us and answers our questions about why our sons are dead, end quote. So that was in response to the shotgun blasts in the air.
One of the things I think, Mark, that Cindy Sheehan has come to epitomize is a single-mindedness of purpose with regard to what she wants to ask President Bush and what she would be satisfied with a response, or what would satisfy her in terms of a response from this president. She has not wavered about that. She wants to confront the president directly about the war that killed her son. And, you know, all of these other things, the shotgun blast, the country music, the smears of the likes of Bill O'Reilly and Michelle Malkin, it all becomes secondary to that central concern. And I think that's what's drawn so many people to her.
I think it's interesting that there is a lot of rallying around Cindy. I don't think she set out to be the leader of a movement.
Absolutely not.
But because of her, you know, proximity to the issue, because she lost her son, because she has questions, because she was, you know, a youth minister, she was a reach out person, she is a spiritual person, she was a person that obviously, whether she had any control over it or not, watched her son go off to Iraq on his own choice. He may not have wanted to end up there, but it was his duty to do so, and this horrible thing has happened, and I think because of that, she has galvanized a lot of people who may not have been activists. She obviously has galvanized a lot of people who have lost loved ones or children in Iraq, but she's also galvanized people like myself and like you, who, you know, we haven't talked much about the peace movement because there was so much justification for the war that, certainly going into Afghanistan, you know, after the attacks of 9/11, that the peace movement had a very hard time struggling to identify, to assimilate itself into what was happening.
Yeah.
And now with Cindy Sheehan, the topic of peace, the idea of peace, the moral issue of peace is now at the forefront of the cultural dialogue again, which is where it should be.
I think you're absolutely right, Mark, that she did not view herself as a leader. But she took a step that a lot, and this is what I think sets her apart. She took a step that most of us wouldn't. She decided to make what for her at the time was a one-person protest. She didn't say, you know, I want this one and that one, or I need the NAACP, or I need this organization or that organization, or a peace movement. She decided as an individual, this is what I'm going to do to seek answers, to seek some, because part of this, Mark, I believe, is that she really has not achieved closure. In terms of the passing of her son, it is a traumatic experience for any parent to lose a child.
Absolutely, and to show that you know she may not, you know, the idea that she's doing this to grandstand or that she is spearheading a movement is ridiculous. Cindy actually said to the folks that have come out from got up on the back of a pickup truck, and I want to quote this. I saw this in one of the pieces. Quote: "Who knew that the beginning of the end of the occupation of Iraq was going to start in Crawford, Texas, last Saturday? Who knew that America would finally stand up and say, we are sick and tired of this, bring our troops home," end quote. You know, I mean, you know, she's a
plain-spoken woman.
But she's also, I think, rising to the occasion. Every time we've talked to her, she's had a lot of humility. She's had a consistency of tone, and it still remains very personal. And this is really what one of the moral issues of this country should be. It should not be a discussion of how to more integrate religion into our private lives or into the laws of this country. It should not be about abortion. It should not be about whether gay people can get married or not. Peace should be one of the most important moral issues that's discussed in this country, and I think that with Cindy Sheehan, we're seeing that re-energized.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier, Mark, the whole notion of peace, race, and poverty being, the overarching concerns of the 1970s.
Well, moral issues that were discussed on behalf of the Democrats, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you fast forward 30-odd years later, and you see, as you point out, that you know, the whole stage of discussion has been co-opted to emphasize and focus on other things, while these three issues remain issues.
Absolutely. I mean, that really blew me away in watching old television. I got to watch more old television. I'm going to have to go sit at the Museum of Broadcasting to look at how politicians spoke at different times. Because, as I said, this was, Fred Harris, who was a senator from Oklahoma. He was the DNC chair for a while. And this was it must have been 1971.
Yeah.
And he was discussing, you know, he had his wife there. They were discussing, you know, Indian issues, but they were also discussing, you know, the Democratic Party. And it was the same thing. Cabot's like, who's going to be running in 72? I don't see, do you got any ideas? And Fred was like, I don't really know. You never know what's going to happen. Like, the same type of discussions have always gone on. And, you know, because I am just, you know, sort of more awake politically than I ever have been, I'm thinking like, oh my God, don't they have their act together? Don't they, you know, this happens in every cycle. You don't know what the nominations process is going to look like. You don't know who's going to all of a sudden start shining or stand out. Mm-hmm. But just the idea that what moral issues were, because he's very specific. He just said the moral issues are peace, race, and poverty. And today, if you were to ask anybody on the street, what are the moral issues confronting our country? They would say abortion, gay marriage, mm-hmm. and church and state issues, which is just nuts, because the right, the religious right specifically, has hijacked the dialogue of cultural morality. It really should be back where it was in the early 70s when a Democratic senator, Fred Harris, said, you know, peace, race, and poverty. We're going to talk to Cindy Sheehan in just a little bit. And speaking about this, maybe we'll get into the last Sunday was Justice Sunday 2, which did not have the same resonance that the first one did. Bill Frist wasn't there. And Tom DeLay went, but those are probably the only friends he has left. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. People in my heart lies a melody, a song of old Santa Claus, where in dreams I live with a memory beneath the stars all along. Cause it was there I found beside the Alamo, enchantment strange as the blue above. A moonlit past that only she could know. Still hears my broken song of love.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Twenty past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's Monday. Wake up, sheeple. How are you, man? Sorry it's the beginning of the week again. Well, maybe you're excited about it. I don't know. I'm kind of excited. I got a little cold, but I'm doing all right.
Yeah.
You feeling okay, buddy?
Feeling great.
Monday's going to be kind of goofy, man.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're not necessarily on the A game. All right, here we go. I sneezed on air earlier. That was the first. Brendan P.W. McDonald actually said, came in and said, I've never heard anyone sneeze on air before. And I'm like, well, we're free here, and we're letting it out. I'm being honest with my listeners.
There you go.
Hey, you're going to want to tune in tomorrow to us, because if you're a Dave Chappelle fan, his TV show may be dead, but Sony Entertainment is releasing Dave's uncensored Showtime special on DVD, and we've got five copies to give away. But you're going to have to be a Dave Chappelle fan in order to win them, because we've got a tricky little game we're going to play to find out our winner. So I want you to tune in tomorrow to win a copy of Dave Chappelle's new DVD, For What It's Worth, it's called. For What It's Worth. We'll also be having another big live broadcast on Friday. We're going to go up to Amy Roof's in Harlem. We'll have pro wrestler Mick Foley, comedian Mike B., and best-selling author Bret Easton Ellis is going to be with us. We have free coffee giveaways. It's Soul Food and Sedition this Friday morning at Amy Roof's on 116th Street between 7th and Lenox Avenues.
Yeah, from that's what one 6 end, to 9. By the way.
One end.
Our cheat sheet has it with Lenox with two N's.
Well, it's good you cleared that up for the listeners.
Thank you.
All right, so again, good morning, San Antonio, Texas, KTXX 103.1 FM, Air America, San Antonio, we're there. Look, you know, Riley, I got another phone call from the execs down at 6th Avenue saying our show has to make more money. Apparently, the executive forgot to budget for staples and carpeting. So here's today's product placement. That's just the beginning of the list. Here's today's product placement minute. Chris is not here, and his name is here. Tim, Chris is on vacation. Tim, the librarian, is working the board up. Could you please give me the product placement music before I shoot myself in the head? All right, thank you. So Riley, what's our product placement story today?
A Mexican settlement near the U.S. border was reduced to rubble after a tanker truck collided with a train, setting off a massive explosion that killed two people and injured at least 44.
Wow, that's the worst thing I've ever heard. Say, is that a live lobster?
Sure is, Mark. Courtesy of Lamar Seafood on West 46th Street.
New York's famous restaurant row.
The freshest seafood on the west side. I'm just going to pop it into this boiling pot here. Come on. Get in here, you little dickens.
You got him in there. Say, so anyways, where was that explosion?
Lucio Blanco, 6 miles south of the Rio Grande. The truck was hauling two tank loads of liquid petroleum gas and didn't stop when the train sounded.
Mm.
There, my lobster's done.
Wow, that was fast.
Lamar's guarantees fast, friendly service and an award-winning Chilean sea bass. Just let me crack open the tail.
Yeah, so the best way to get the meat out of that claw is to suck it out there, Riley.
Wait a minute, hold on for a second. The truck driver and the train engineer are dead, and it took several hours to find all the injured.
Do you eat that green stuff in the middle?
Yo, I sure do. Aggravating rescue efforts, the area had no water lines, forcing Texas fire crews to ferry water trucks back and forth to a hydrant near the International Bridge at Los Indios.
Wow, that's just heartbreaking. So for the benefit of our listeners who are as disturbed by this story as I am, let me just ask, when is Lamar's open and which credit cards do they accept?
Okay, well, let me put this claw down.
Yeah.
Lamar's is open for dinner from 5 to 11 p.m. and for lunch from noon to 3 p.m. They accept all major plastic, including Diners Club, interestingly enough, which you almost never see anymore.
Wow, thanks, Mark. That was a tragic story.
But it was a good lobster.
It looked good, man,
yeah.
From where I'm sitting. So we're gonna have Cindy Sheehan on the line in just a few minutes. We're also going to be talking to journalist William Martin about the Houston preacher Joel Osteen, who many people are familiar with from his TV broadcasts.
Man, these guys collectively, all of these televangelists, and I include the African-American ones in this, they just make my skin crawl.
I used to enjoy watching Robert Tilton. He's hilarious. He's the one that spoke in tongues, and he would do that thing where he'd be like, oh, suppose, blah, 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 you know, and he used to hold up. I almost did this. I remember one night, I don't know if I told this story. I must have told this story at some point where I was sitting at home at night. I lived in San Francisco at the time. I was probably high. I was probably sad. I remember I had a stomach ache, and Tilton, I'm watching Tilton in the middle of the night, and he does that thing where he raises his hand. He says, someone out there got a pain in their stomach.
Oh, yeah.
I sense there's somebody out there with a pain in their stomach. Well, that person would just come to his TV screen, place his hand on my hand. I will ease that pain. And I had that moment where I'm like, I'm moving towards the TV with my hand, and I'm like, whoa, dude, kind of, you know, I would rather be caught masturbating than, you know, be sitting in front of the TV with my hand on the screen if my my wife at the time were to walk in. Because at least I could explain to myself if I was masturbating, be like, you know what this is.
You could?
Yeah, of course. But if I was on my knees with my hand on the television set during a religious broadcasting, I'd be hard-pressed for something to say. I mean,
well, you know, this is the faith healer thing that they've been doing for, I guess, going back now several generations. Oral Roberts was the one who kind of perfected it, but he did it with a live audience. You know, they'd have people, well, I don't want to say that he was cheating or anything, but they'd have people in the audience, and they'd call
Chills.
Them up front, yeah, and they'd say, heal! And when I was a little kid, I used to think this was real, just like Santa Claus. It was incredible.
Yeah, and there's a great video that was going on, going around of Robert Tilden doing his broadcasting, but someone had cut in farts. Like, you know, like he would, it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life, and I don't know if you can still find it around, but I just remember I was hanging out with Louis C.K. once, and he got hold of it. And it's one of those things that the first time you see it, you'll never laugh harder. Yeah. And I remember, like, I watched it at his house, and I came back, like, a week later, and I'm like, yeah, let's watch that thing again. He's like, no, I'm not going to watch it anymore, because I don't want to ruin its funny. Like, he literally was savoring it, like, it was so funny that he was, like, keeping himself away from it so he could still enjoy the laughs later. Speaking about, farting preachers, James Dobson at Justice Sunday 2, was trying to make an appeal to the religious fanatics to disagree with the nomination process of the United States Supreme Court and try to instigate some more fury and frenzy around getting their own activist judges into office. These guys are anti-democratic, they're anti-American, and they want to hijack the constitutional process and make this a theocracy. The only real politician that was there was Tom DeLay, because that's the only place he can show his face without being ridiculed and pointed at. It's 27 past the hour. We'll be talking to Cindy Sheehan momentarily. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Monday. Wake up, sheeple. If you're just getting up, do what you can. Pull it together. Get some coffee. Do something. Hey, our show's amazing, Mark. The balance that we sort of go back and forth between things. And, you know, we're going to be talking to Cindy Sheehan in a minute, but I did want to reach out to the people that were listening to the last segment. We had a couple of calls and tell you that that you can get the Robert Tilden fart video if you go on the internet and just do a search on Robert Tilden fart. Let's take that call. Why not? Mark in Atlanta, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. Thanks for the fish, by the way.
Sure, sure. what's going on, man?
I know the origin of that tape. I know when it was made and where and why.
You do?
I do.
Okay.
It was made, believe it or not, by the media department of Oral Roberts University.
What?
I swear, I would not lie about something like this, and I don't have to because I think I may be the only ORU person listening to this radio station.
I wouldn't bet the store on that. My pastor is a graduate of ORU.
Really?
Yeah.
Really. Actually, I worked out there for a while.
And that was made in the media department at Oral Roberts University as a planned assault on another televangelist or just for kicks?
I think it was just for kicks. I mean, even in those evangelical circles, Robert Tilden's a bit of a joke, and he brings this kind of thing on himself. If you watch the tape, which I'm sure everybody in the world that listens to you now is going to find it and watch it, you'll see why it was made, because he brings this kind of thing on himself with his mannerism.
Yeah, it's a hilarious tape, and I think the original version, it's like, well, it's like 15, 20 minutes long, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty long. It was the copy of I have is actually shorter, because it was like I guess one of the originals. And I think the shorter version is funnier because it ends right in the middle of how hilarious it is. It doesn't sort of peter.
Yeah, no, I noticed that. Well, thanks for the call and the information, Mark. I appreciate
it.
Take it easy.
All right, take care.
It is one of the funniest things you'll see if you like that kind of humor. Now, I'm not, I'll tell you honestly, Mark, I'm not a big fart humor kind of guy, but I'll tell you, I got some big laughs out of that. Hey, look at that. Look at that. Tim the Librarian's getting a few chuckles. It's nice of you to show up and laugh a little bit after you screwed up that bit a while back.
Oh, anyways, but that's cold, man.
That's right, man. He's doing a good job.
He is.
He grew up in a difficult environment. With his
well, mother. He wasn't allowed to make too much noise.
Yeah, his mom was a librarian. He's got a lot of be quiet. So look at this. In terms of George Bush, he made an incredible comment that James Wolcott responded to earlier around Cindy Sheehan's presence just outside of his ranch in Texas, as opposed to talking to her or confronting her face-to-face and answering some of the questions that she wants answered or acting like a leader at all. Just before he's going off on a bike ride, he said, quote, "I think it's also important for me to go on with my life to keep a balanced life," end quote. So this is the president of the United States, the leader of the free world, about to go on a bike ride saying, "Hey, come on, I got to get on with my stuff here."
Yeah, you not know? Now, I'm busy.
I got to get on with my stuff. So
I don't understand how he figures he can get away with this sort of thing. It's not like Cindy Sheehan is an unknown quantity at this point. You would think he'd have a little bit more to say. Maybe he was just caught in one of those things where he was actually required to think and improvise on his own.
Let's continue our Texas theme here. We're trying to get Cindy Sheehan on the phone, but right now on the phone with us is our guest. He has a piece in the upcoming issue of Texas Monthly about one of the most popular preachers in the country, who oddly, I think, has some of Robert Tilden's mannerisms. Joel Osteen, joining us by phone from Wimberley, Texas, is William Martin. Good morning, William.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So the piece is a very in-depth piece about a very charismatic personality and the evolution of one of the most popular preachers in this country. What has been the reaction to your article from either side?
Well, it's been mixed. I'd say many of my friends have said, "Wow, you really like the guy, don't you?" That's a very positive piece. And some people in the church have said that, and others have said they can't believe that I was belittling Joel Osteen, which I really don't. If you've seen the article, I don't feel I did.
Well, for some, I think for some believers, anything other than a complete elevation, if there's anything that may seem, even if it's historical, as seeing shedding a weird light on the guy, they'll think that you've slandered him somehow.
That's true. And there, I wrote a biography of Billy Graham called A Prophet with Honor, and there were some who thought I should have left out the material about his relationship to the presidents, which, of course, it would be something of a gap.
Now, this Joel Osteen, I'm not incredibly familiar with his work. I tend to watch those guys for the wrong reasons. But I do know that there is a movement in the mega church movement that is sort of gearing the preaching towards self-help more. Is he one of those?
Yes, that's fair. He would see, and he's often acknowledged that he doesn't really object to the idea of being thought of as a Christian motivational speaker.
Mm-hmm.
That's not all he does, but it's very much an uplifting. He gives lots of practical advice to people, and much of it is actually quite good.
So some of this stuff is not, there are some reports I've read of churches almost barely mentioning Jesus.
Well, in his service, in the sermons that one is likely to hear on television, he doesn't mention Jesus very much. He doesn't quote much scripture. He's talking mainly about practical things that people can use in their lives, and he readily acknowledges that. In the other church services, the services just for the church, Wednesday night services and things like that, it's more conventionally Christian and scriptural.
Uh-huh. How big is his congregation? I tend to, I'll be honest with you William, I have a problem with religious fanaticism. I feel that they could be a threat to the fabric of the country if they are politicized, and you don't see this guy that way, do you?
Well, he refuses to get involved in politics. He doesn't speak out on the hot-button issues. He doesn't tell people where to vote, and he has a very mixed ethnic congregation, and he really doesn't. He stays pretty clear of politics.
Well, that's interesting. And how many people is his? How big is his flock, as they say?
Well, at the former church, as many people have heard, he's just moved from a church that held from a building that held 7,800 people, and they had four services a week and packed them out. Got about 30,000 people every Sunday. Now they've moved into the former Compaq Center where the Houston Rockets played. That will hold 16,000. And they plan to have three services each, three major services. They also have a smaller Spanish-speaking service that draws only 3,000 people, which, of course, would be a huge church in many places.
That's unbelievable.
They drew 50,000, more than 50,000 the first weekend. They don't expect, and that should drop down a little bit more to the normal, the former figure of about 30,000, but it wouldn't surprise me if they're drawing 40,000 to 50,000 within 6 months.
Wow.
William Martin, is this just because Joel Osteen is simply mediagenic? Is that what draws people to? I mean, 16,000 people is extraordinary under any circumstances. What is it about? Is it his essence? I mean, there are a lot of people that are out there doing this. What makes him so special?
Well, he's quite good at it. He is a very superb communicator. He's likable. He's funny without trying to be a comic. He's often uses some self-deprecating humor. He, so far, has never been caught, and there's never any kind of suspicion that he's misusing money. Or, in fact, they don't even ask for money on the program. That was one of the stipulations that his father put in when they first put in the television program 17 or 18 years ago. We won't ask for money. We don't want to be associated with, you mentioned Bob Tilton in the introduction.
Mm-hmm.
He's really quite a long way from Bob Tilton.
Oh, yeah, I just noticed that, like, when I went on to, I knew enough about him, when I talked to you, I went and watched some footage of his preaching, of Osteen's preaching, and I just noticed that there are certain behaviors and mannerisms of humility and reverence that some of these guys tend to share. It's almost like there is a manual by which they work from, or perhaps just a history of preaching in his family. Maybe he took some tricks from his dad. I don't know, but there does seem to be certain mannerisms that are used by many of them.
Well, I think it is certainly the case that preachers tend to, in different circles at least, by denomination and by larger evangelical Pentecostal circles, that preachers do tend to share some mannerisms, which
sure.
they gain by watching other preachers.
Right. So now, they are making a lot of money, I got to assume. And what are they doing with that money? How much money are they making?
Well, their annual income last year was about $60 million.
Oh, that's all?
Most of it, they acknowledge that that's going to have to rise because they spent something like $95 million on revamping the compact center. They spend a lot of it just on getting their television program. They're in 150 countries, and they're in seven different cable networks, and in the network affiliates of approximately 35 in city of the largest markets in the country. So they spend an awful lot just on getting their basic message out.
All right, William Martin from Texas Monthly. We're talking to you about Joel Osteen, and I can't help but think that on some level, you know, I've read about these mega churches that are taking money, they're building community centers, they're building towns, they're building schools, they're creating the beginning of cities, and now you know they reach out into millions of people across the entire planet. That I have to believe. On some level, that kind of religious entrepreneuring is bad. It's detrimental in some way.
Why do you believe that?
Because I believe that initially they will be called upon to be a political force, and that you know that it can't be trusted. And I believe that they are purveying a certain type of morality that can become an imposition on the culture.
Well, it's certainly possible for that to happen, and there are a number of mega churches that. Certainly line up with the religious right, that there are political forces, no question about that. The Lakewood Church so far has not done that. In fact, they have explicitly declined to do that. So what you're talking about clearly has happened and can happen and perhaps could happen to this church. It's been interesting to me to watch it, and I've been watching the Lakewood Church since it was in a building that held 230 members.
Mm.
And so I've watched it throughout its now through four decades, or nearly four decades, and it has not so far succumbed to that, which has been an interesting thing for me to watch.
Okay.
William Martin, the idea that faith comes to people seems to play a pretty strong role, both certainly in John Osteen's life, maybe not in Joel's because he was born into it, but I was curious about whether or not you think that's what draws people, that they live a certain kind of life and then suddenly, I mean, this is true with the president too. This is his story. He was leading a certain kind of life and then he became a born again Christian.
Right. Well, that's called conversion. Conversion does happen. It happens in a, not just to religion, but it certainly is a primary religious phenomenon. Not all people experience it. You mentioned, Billy Graham has talked about that he never had that kind of overwhelming experience. He just grew up in it, and I think that's what happened to Joel.
Yeah.
Many people who are attracted to this church or to other churches find that their lives are not going so well. They've got trouble with their marriages, their children, some kinds of addictions, and they come and they have a supporting community, they have a positive message, and they get a lot of help. You mentioned about sort of little cities. Sociologist Peter Berger uses an image of the sacred canopy. And some of these mega churches really establish an alternate world where people can come in, they have their friends, they have their entertainment.
Well, now I'm going to have to, William, I'm going to have to be keeping an eye on this particular world because you've got me interested as well. And I appreciate you being with us this morning.
Thanks a lot, William.
Sure.
You take care. Bye-bye. He seemed to be very, he liked it. He seems to like the place. He's in reverence of it, but it makes me nervous. It's 47 past the hour. We'll see if we can get Cindy Sheehan on the line. Stay with us, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Dateline, New York, the city we built on rock and roll. Hi, kids. This is your War on Brains correspondent, Mort Milfington, reminding you to always stay informed. And when you can't do that, try listening to Morning Sedition every morning here on Air America Radio, your Xanadu, now with Splenda.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We got to land this thing. I'm sorry that we didn't get Cindy Sheehan on the phone. Sometimes, because of what's going on down there, we talk to a couple of people, and it just seems like there's just a lot of people in a little bit of space, and, we tried, and then we've been talking to her every day, and we'll get her on the phone tomorrow.
Try and get her tomorrow, yeah.
That's all. So, look, we're going to I wanted to talk about this guy, Ron Grembin. He's a San Francisco electrical engineer and an environmentalist, and he's created the Grembin. You ever heard of it? No, you haven't. It's a car. It looks like a standard Prius, but in the trunk are 18 brick-sized batteries. And what's happened here is he's upped the ante. He's upped what would you call it? He's made a hybrid car that literally can get some of these kind of cars can get up to 250 miles per gallon. You can plug it into the wall, recharge the batteries, and because there's so much battery power there, the amount of gas it needs to use is a lot less, and it makes it more efficient. But 250 miles. Per gallon. That's mind blowing. Now, automakers, obviously, they try to shut the door on this kind of stuff because they're like, that's too efficient. We've got a game to play here. We've got, we've got oil companies that need to make money. We got to make money. You make a good car, then no one's going to buy two of them or three of them or need one in a few years. But now it seems to me that because conservatives, the one thing that some real fiscal conservatives and liberals and progressives are sharing is the idea that we have to detach ourselves from Middle Eastern oil.
Well, see, here's the problem. When they develop, these things have been in the pipeline for better than 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
When there is an oil embargo like there was in the late 1970s, or when gas prices are high like they are now, there's a lot of interest. When the price drops, for example, during the mid to late 1990s when gas was 75 cents to a dollar a gallon, nobody cared about these fuel-efficient vehicles because everybody said, well, the gas is so cheap, we're not going to have to worry about it. And if you look across the history of this stuff being developed, you find that when gas is cheap and plentiful, people don't care. People go out and buy five Humvees to put in their yard.
You know, they're also showing now that people don't care as much as you would think they would. I mean, gas is almost $3 a gallon. Doesn't show any sign of going down or any sign that people are not buying as much gas.
No, but you know what? There's a coming confrontation, and we've talked about this before. And part of this is going to play itself out in Iraq and Iran. The Chinese consume almost as much fossil fuel products as we do. And if the Chinese sit up one day and say, wait a minute, we can't have you going into Iran because you're interrupting our ability to access oil that we need to run our industries. We're going to be on a collision course with 1.5 billion people.
Yeah, when China wants to call in all its, what do you call that? When they call their...
Markers.
Exactly. When China calls in all its markers, we're going to understand who actually owns the world.
That's right.
It's very frightening. But I like these kind of stories. And of course, a guy who, from Northern California, because Northern and Southern California is really where car culture began, is now figured out a way to make a car that goes 250 miles per gallon.
Yeah.
All right, there's the effects from the Streisand compound. Here's the liberal agenda for today. Here are your marching orders. One, if he's convicted, suggest that Jack Abramoff give him everyone in America an all-expense-paid golfing trip to Scotland. Two, locate your nearest neighbor named Bush and camp out on his lawn until he answers some tough questions about the war in Iraq. Three, to irritate your conservative boss, show up at the office in a short-sleeved shirt and jeans every day for the next 3 weeks and tell him you're just following the president's example. Four, Arnold Schwarzenegger is raising money for his special election in November by charging people to sit with him in a luxury box for the Rolling Stones concert in Boston. Try to convince the Stones that night to play nothing but sweet neocon. Today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation. Bush says he'll use force against Iran only as the last resort. Wake up, sheeple. Force is his favorite resort. He spends all his long, long vacations there, and we have to tip the housekeepers. That's it for today, Riley. So tomorrow...
we've got Keith Beauchamp. He was with us before. He's the one that did the untold story of Emmett Lewis Till.
The documentary.
Yeah, and he got stuff done with that documentary.
Right, I think the documentary is actually going to be opening here in New York down at the Film Forum. We've also got another Welcome to San Antonio, KTXX, 103.1 FM. Welcome to Air America. Also, we'll be in Harlem this Friday for the live broadcast at Amy Roots up there on 116th Street. If you want to come down for that, we'll be talking about that all this week.
Yeah.
And also the big Chappelle DVD giveaway tomorrow. So get your Chappelle trivia together, and we're going to give away five of this unreleased, uncensored Showtime special that he did. Have a good day.
Have a good one. It was fun, Maron. This is Air America Radio.